This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Nathan Englander, has a new collection of short stories called What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. His subjects are often dark, but the tone is often comic. Several of the stories in his new book are about tensions between Orthodox and secular Jews, the aftermath of the Holocaust, and conflicts about the future of Israel. Englander was raised in a Jewish Orthodox family, neighborhood, and school. When he was a young man, he moved to Israel for a few years. And there, he quickly gave up on organized religion. So you may find it surprising that he spent the past 2 years translating the traditional Jewish book, the Haggadah, which tells the story of the exodus of Jews from Egypt. It's read at the Seder table during Passover. The new translation, called New American Haggadah, was edited by writer Jonathan Safran Foer and will be published next month. He spoke with Terry last week.
Nathan Englander, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with a reading from the title story of your new collection, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. Do you want to set it up or do you want to just start reading?
That's funny. Anytime I set it up, I get metaphysical. It takes about 67 minutes. So, yes. So I don't think you want me to set up anything at all, especially if it's the start of a story, except to say this one is, you know, it's the title story of the book, and it is very terrifyingly to me. But the commitment I made in this story is I married it to Carver's very legendary story, What We Talk About When We Talk About Love.
Okay.
They're in our house maybe 10 minutes, and already Mark's lecturing us on the Israeli occupation. Mark and Lauren live in Jerusalem, and people from there think it gives them the right. Mark is looking all stoic and nodding his head. If we had what you have down here in South Florida, he says and trails off. Yup, he says, and he's nodding again. We'd have no troubles at all. You do have what we have, I tell him. All of it. Sun and palm trees, old Jews and oranges, and the worst drivers around. At this point, I say, we've probably got more Israelis than you. Debbie, my wife, she puts a hand on my arm. Her signal that I'm taking a tone or interrupting someone's story, sharing something private, or making an inappropriate joke. That's my cue. And I'm surprised, considering how much I get it, that she ever lets go of my arm. Yes, you've got it all now, Mark says, even terrorists. I look to Lauren. She's the one my wife has the relationship with, the one who should take charge. But Lauren isn't going to give her husband any signal. She and Mark ran off to Israel 20 years ago and turned Hasidic, and neither of them will put a hand on the other in public. Not for this, not to put out a fire.
That's Nathan Englander reading the title story from his new collection, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. I can assure you I've heard that conversation many times.
That's funny.
Have you?
Yes. I think that was actually, as someone who spent a lot of years living in Jerusalem, one of the great perks was that when you come back and you get into these Israel arguments in your American Jewish clan, you can really just silence them by saying, I live there. So we used it like a bludgeon. You know, when people would say, like, you know, I'm AIPAC, I'm this, move that, move the, you know, embassy needs to be there. The embassy should have a Starbucks and be on the Temple Mount, whatever. You know, people do that. You'd say, I live there. And that was how we kept everybody quiet.
So another thing that happens in the story, in addition to the disagreements about Israel and about religion, the two couples, the Hasidic couple and the secular couple, play a game that is called the Righteous Gentile Game, or Who Will Hide Me. Will you describe the game?
I will describe it, and for the audience at home and in their cars and on their podcasts, I'm beet red with embarrassment as I explain this. It's so deeply personal, and it's not a game, and that's the point. I call it a game. It makes it easier to talk about it as a game, but it's something we play with dead seriousness in my family. And that is, you know, we would, you know, wonder who would hide us in the Holocaust if there were a second Holocaust. And I think that's sort of the interest for me, you know, as a, I don't know what to count myself as a fourth generation or fifth generation. I was just arguing about this. We've been in America a long time. You know what I'm saying? I have great grandparents born here. And that idea that my sister, because of our religious education, were raised in a sense, we have the minds of, you know, like survivors' kids, you know, in the States, which is a very strange concept for such deeply, you know, we have no one with accents in our world. Anyway, we really were raised with this idea of a looming second Holocaust, and we would play this game, you know, wondering who would hide us. And this story, I've been carrying it in my head for 20 years ago. It must have been 20 years ago, but I remember my sister said about a couple we knew, she said, he would hide us and she would turn us in. And it struck me so deeply, and I put it on the neighbors in this story, but I just couldn't shake that thought for all these years because it's true. And I guess, I don't know, for this book is, you know, everything, every book better be fully intimate. It better be all you have. I'm obviously not shy because I'm going to talk your ear off today, but I'm private, which is different. But that idea is for me to be truly intimate, for me to be naked and raw. The fiction allows me to do what I need to do emotionally. And with this book, I don't know, it was suddenly certain stories were looking at things. It was a chance for me to look at things that were right there. In a sense, this is totally, it's normality, this game. And I just took a step back and said, my God, we're pathological.
So the impression I'm getting is that, okay, you were brought up in Long Island in a prosperous suburban community, but you're brought up as if a new Holocaust is right around the corner, so start preparing because you're going to be marched off to a death camp unless you find a neighbor or a friend willing to risk their life to hide you. And it's such an embattled mentality, such a paranoid mentality to be carrying around in a prosperous Long Island suburb in what, the 1960s?
The 70s and 80s. I'm born in 1970. I'm a disco kid by a month. But yes, the 70s and 80s. But you know what? I think it was this strange thing. I mean, it was, you know, I'm living back in Brooklyn, and I was very resistant to doing that. You know, I live up the block from my dad's high school, and my uncle went to school, you know, behind our building at Pratt. You know, there was all these Brooklyn dads, and they made this exodus, and, you know, a lot of them went to public school. They were religious, but that generation went to public schools. Like, they built these yeshivas, and they spent, you know what I'm saying, you know, that's where prosperity comes in. It was this education that I so fought against and so rebelled against and worked so hard to leave was a huge, huge, you know, effort for my parents to give me that education. You know, it's just wildly expensive. But but the point is we had these old school rabbis. So I think that's why I write the way I do. I studied with Marilyn Robinson at Iowa. God bless her. She taught me many wonderful things. But one thing she taught me was that I was writing all my sentences in sort of transliterated Yiddish. So, you know, so, you know what I'm saying? My mom's, you know, Boston, you know, she's a Boston and my dad's from Brooklyn, but I hear everything, you know, I should wait all day here for you to show up 5 minutes late. You know what I'm saying? That's because we went to school. We got there at, you know, 8 in the morning and left at 5. You know, college was easy for us. We were in school a million hours a day with these sort of Brooklyn raised or old country rabbis yelling at us in that rhythm. And I feel like that's the rhythm in my head. So I basically receive these messages from the rabbis about what the world will do. My point is, as living as the Holocaust is for me, as an idea of something that just happened and can happen, I feel the same way about the Inquisition. You know what I'm saying? My heart, seriously, I think of the
I'm
poor
sorry,
rabbi.
I'm laughing.
I was going to say, you are just have no empathy for the losses of the Inquisition. Obviously, you're a Mel Brooks fan. But
Let me just stop you here. So you're brought up with fear that the Holocaust can happen any second.
Yeah.
Maybe the Spanish Inquisition, in which all the Jews from Spain were expelled. How did that affect the rest of your mentality? Did you grow up a worrier, paranoid? Did fear infiltrate other aspects of your life?
I think we can call it a day right now. I've just reached the very core of my soul. I thought it would be a longer interview. But yes, that is, I am constantly in a state of fear. So yeah, you know what I was going to say? Let's, you know, it's just between us, so I might as well tell you everything. But the point is, so this is what I'm getting as an education, is this education of, you know, fear and betrayal and Jewish history, which is not, you know, amplified. It just is. But yes, my mother raised me very clearly that if you cross the street, you will die. If you go outside, you will die. If you play sports, you will likely die. So that's what I was getting at home. But, you know, I don't, my point is, I think it may have had a larger imprint on my soul. I don't think other people are worried about it as much. But that story, how we avenged the Blooms in the book, that is a war that we had with the anti-Semites of our town. You know what I'm saying? And those things, when you wear a yarmulke, that's the idea. It's you know, communing with God, this idea of making a symbol for yourself and for everyone of your relationship and your religion. But that idea of walking down that street, you know, I call it in the story, the chased home from schools. I mean, but those, you know, swastikas, I remember, you know, driving by with my dad and seeing, you know, red swastikas on the sign for, you know, the synagogue, or a shaving cream one on our door on Halloween. You know, those kind of fights and battles and curses. But that, so, we really had that escalated war with the anti-Semites in our town. It was insane.
So that actually reinforced all your fears.
Yes. And I think, as long as we're there, I'm going to tilt this chair back and lay down and turn this into straight up therapy. But I think that's why Jerusalem was why I had to live there all those years. I mean, I've been endlessly tortured. My friends found it, you know, it was never not entertaining that I decided I was some, you know, lefty, atheistic hippie and then went off to live in Jerusalem for all those years. But there's a reason. You know what I'm saying? I was so, you know, think about my grandfather on my mother's side, who's reformed, like what it was for these like shtetl kids to show up at the house. You know, he loved us dearly, but I just even conceptually, like with the yarmulke and the tzitzis and, you know, all this stuff, I spent my time, my childhood in America feeling Jewish and not American. And it's only in Israel, it was those years there where I finally got to be an American. You know, everybody's
okay.
A Jew.
Now, people would probably think it would be the other way around, that you'd go to Israel and become more religious because it is, after all, the Jewish state. So how is it that you ended up becoming secular in Israel?
You know, I've really been comparing it lately, very gingerly but sincerely, to friends' coming out stories. I think when you grow up in a world and your parents are one way, and you're told this is your world, this is how the whole world is, and this is how you're supposed to be, and you are terribly unhappy in that world, it's a very scary thing. You know, to me, there was no such thing as being a cultural Jew. So that idea, I just didn't connect. I wouldn't meet someone who said, oh, yeah, I you know, my mom's Jewish, or, you know, yeah, I think, you know, we did Purim one year. Like, there was no leap that I could make that I could connect and say, here is a path, this is a world that I can connect with. And when I got to Israel and see these people, you know, living in Hebrew, living that life, to me, it was the first time I saw Jews who were so, you know, who had the biblical references, all this stuff, deeply secular, atheistic Jews who I could identify with. And I mean, the first week there is when I gave up organized religion. Like, my first Shabbat in Israel is I broke it after, you know, 19 years.
So this was the first time you saw a community of Jews who weren't Orthodox?
Well, no, I went to, you know, I was going to say, for me growing up on Long Island, it was this idea. I mean, it was so wild and racy from my town that I even went away to state school. And for me, that was a world crack open because I met Jews from other parts of Long Island. To me, it was like being at the UN. It was crazy. You know, I loved it. I was just, that was wildly exciting. And then my real breakaway was to fly around the world and meet Jews from other countries. You know, it was just, that was my opening out.
Just giving new meaning to the word multicultural.
Yeah, exactly. I'm multi-monocultural.
So what did it feel like that first Sabbath when you did not observe the Sabbath?
It was, I remember what it was. It was taking a bus back from Tiberias. You know, certain buses can leave before the end of Shabbat. And I got on a bus with my friends before the end of Shabbat from Tiberias. You know, the experience was simply that I was sure that I had killed everybody on the bus, that God would have to throw that bus off a cliff and that it was my fault. So I was not only going to die, but I was killing the others, and I felt pretty bad about that.
And how did it feel when you didn't die on the Sabbath?
It felt like I wanted a cheeseburger.
Oh, mixing meat and dairy,
yes.
Which is not
yes.
Kosher. So did
no.
you break the kosher thing on?
I did. This was before a million or so Russians had come to Israel, and you could get, you know, pork at every, you know, that there were butchers around town. It was pretty hard to break that rule. I had to wait months to find a cheeseburger back at that time. But yeah, my buddy had flown to London. I literally got out at Victoria Station, my first trip to England, and went up the stairs into Burger King and had me a Whopper.
Let's get back to Terry's interview with Nathan Englander. His collection of short stories, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, draws on his experiences growing up in an Orthodox Jewish family, neighborhood, and school in Long Island. As a young man, he moved to Israel, where he quickly gave up on organized religion. So it's surprising that he spent the past 2 years doing a new translation of the traditional Jewish text, the Haggadah. It was edited by his friend, the writer Jonathan Safran Foer, and will be published next month. Terry asked Englander to explain what the Haggadah is.
It's the story of Exodus, and every year on Passover, when we all know the Red Sea getting split and the 10 plagues and all that stuff. It's as Jonathan Foer, who is the editor of it, keeps saying, thinks it's, you know, probably the most popular story around. But yes, yeah, so it's a way to commemorate the Jews, you know, freedom from slavery.
And it's basically, you know, a book that is read during the Passover Seder, the dinner, or it's read
right
before the dinner. You did the translation, yes, and I'm sure our listeners who heard the beginning of this interview were thinking, well, why did they choose this guy? This guy used to be Orthodox, then he became really secular, he rebelled against religion, so who is he to be translating a very important religious text? So why you?
You know, I've been working on the translation for 3 years. I think Jonathan's been working on this project for six. But I don't think anybody else could have talked me into it. He really sort of knows how my synapses fire. He's got a good read on my brain. But I thought it was a really bad choice on his part as well. You know, my point is, I've never translated before. I've left religion. Everything you've said. And, you know, he just made it clear that it would be something that we'd really be proud of at the end. He was really adamant about that. And I have to say, it's informed my writing. It's changed the way I think. And having the book here, I'm really thankful for it.
What language did you translate from?
Oh, well, this is the point. I thought also, you know, I speak Hebrew and I'm very familiar with this text. And, I, you know, so that's it. I had the religious education and then I lived in Israel for all those years. So I've got old Hebrew and new Hebrew. So, yeah, it's translated from the Hebrew and Aramaic. It's translated from primary sources.
And what was your ambition? What did you think needed changing? I mean, why do we need a new Haggadah?
We never need new Haggadahs, and there will be endless. It's sort of, I think, of all the traditional Jewish documents, it's the one that's most living. People, there's a Armed Forces Haggadah and an Alcoholics Anonymous Haggadah and an LGBT Haggadah. There are Haggadahs for everything. Some families make them new every year. People, it's a really wonderful living document. And, you know, even Jonathan's choice of the New American Haggadah, they're always of a place. A very legendary one is the Sarajevo Haggadah. They're just constantly made throughout time, and he felt it was time for a new one. But about what made the decision for me to translate it, it was really clear when I went back to think about it and look at texts. You know, I've always used the Hebrew side of the Maxwell House, which is a really great traditional liturgy. The point is, I'd never really looked at the English. And what committed me to it is that back to loving texts, which is the Haggadah, you should read it and weep. It is so beautiful. It is just such a moving document to me. And I looked at, I guess I'm always a naive, you know, back to living in Israel, it's when I think I understood that governments were run by actual people. I thought presidents and prime ministers knew more. There are these great moments. And I just didn't understand, oh my God, translators are people too. They're human being. I just didn't understand that, even as someone who writes books, but about religious texts, you know, that people were making decisions. You're always making decision. And the line I can tell you is that really clinched it for me is in Hebrew, it says, you know, lavdil bein kodesh lekodesh. And in English, it was translated, which is what it means, to differentiate between the Sabbath and the holiday. But in Hebrew, what it says is, you know, to differentiate between holy and holy. And I was like, someone made this decision for clarity and understanding. It means between these 2 days. But to me, the poetry, the metaphysical space, the space between holy and holy, for that to not be there in the English was just, it made me understand that I wanted to do, you know, it turned it from this, what I thought would be a 6-week project into me working with a study partner head to head. It's called Chavruta style, face to face. We studied, you know, I don't even want, my girlfriend says, we can't have a mezuzah on the door, but I have to come home to you with Talmuds and Haggadot piled to the ceiling arguing. You know, it was like living in a study hall for her.
So, you use the term in your translation in referring to God to King of the Cosmos. Now, I can't say that I remember hearing the word cosmos in any services or prayers. And or in the Bible, not that I'd necessarily know. But it seems to me an interesting choice. I think I've heard like King of the Universe, but cosmos? So tell us about using the word cosmos.
You are such a generous reader, as I know both as a listener, but here I am. But thank you. You know what? It's been so long, it just becomes part of you, these projects, but I guess I hadn't thought about it. Those choices were the most wrestled over. You know, it's maybe that one, and also God of Us for Eloheinu. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always our God. So it's this idea, I think, back to language, the things we don't hear anymore. You know, it's you know, something like friendly fire or something, these things that are very loaded and they have meaning and you know the meaning. That's how we get through life in a speedy fashion. You know, words have meanings and we already have them at the ready and we move through them. And I thought people say these things in English, and I think they're forgetting what they're saying. And it means the world to me that you ask that question, because that's the point. You know, because you say universe, you read past it. But that's what it's saying, you know, of the cosmos. And it makes you think. And that's it. And that was really it. I think maybe the most dangerous choice in the whole book was God of us instead of our God. Because we say our God, it's not our God that we own, like our God, our TiVo, our lunchbox. You know what I'm saying? Our God means the God over us. And I really thought about that a ton. And I think that's, you know, I'll see how people respond. But to me, I wanted people to be thinking about what they're saying. If you are, you know, a lot of people, that's the weirdest, you know, again, this choice of me doing it. But I could not take it seriously. And John, I thought we're going to be ironical and sassy, you know, sassy guys, you know. But the point is, we ended up taking it so deeply seriously. And I just felt people are going to be, because I speak the Hebrew, I just always assume people have the same knowledge base as me. I suddenly thought, my God, people are going to be praying from this sincerely. And I owe them a debt. I better think.
So why cosmos and not universe or all?
I was going to say we need a whiteboard or something. These I can't even tell you how many hours of arguing for things like that. But again, I think because it did make you think, A, and I think because to me, you know, just really looking at the Hebrew and thinking of what that word means and just thinking it encompassed the cosmos. And also even that, the biggest point of translation is choice. Every word you're choosing, rhythm, clarity, communication, meaning, intent. And I think maybe, you know, even that one can be the feel of King of the Cosmos does it justice.
You are no longer an observant Jew. Will you have a Seder and use your own Haggadah this year?
Jonathan and I were joking about this. We're like, if we don't find our Haggadahs at the Seder, people are going to be in trouble. But, at least our families can use them. But, I do. I have to say, of all the holidays, I really don't do anything. I really do go to, if I can get to my family, I get there. I've been going to a friend's the last few years. But, yeah, I do the Seder every year. I was going to say, I don't know if I'm softening or finding comfort or some different. My point is, it's okay to live in conflict with yourself. That's a nice thing that I've discovered. It's okay for me to be really secular. That's the idea. People can just, I'm trying to calm down. The point is, I really enjoy that holiday. And yes, I go to a Seder every year and I, you know, drive there and keep a house full of bread and all that stuff. But I really do enjoy that meal and this book.
What were your Seders like as a child?
As you say that, it's really rare for me. I have a brain that only records. I can never remember. I only retain negative memories. It helps with my worldview. But I literally can be like, people like, you know, my girlfriend will be like, you were never happy in childhood. I'm like, not that I recall. You know, when I see a picture of me smiling or my mother tells, I sort of can't remember being happy, but it's my grandparents' house was happy to me. And I think, I do remember the Seders. It's also the idea of the work behind, you know what? What I remember more, it's the switching of dishes. You have to switch your dishes. And this idea, you know, the old country stuff that comes over, the dishes that survive, but it's getting, you know, this boxes of china. You know, we ate on Corningware like everybody else did then, good white plates that you could drop down the stairs and they'd bounce back up, you know. But this idea, suddenly delicate plates would come up from the basement and these big sort of 1920s spoons. And I really remember the stuff of it and the switching of the house. I mean, it is such a huge deal getting the house ready. It's really obsessive, the hunt for, you know, bread.
Well, Nathan Englander, thank you so much for talking with us.
This has been a great pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Nathan Englander speaking with Terry Gross. Englander's new American Haggadah will be published next month. His new collection of short stories is called What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. The new film, Return, centers on a woman's struggle to readjust after coming home from the war. It stars Linda Cardellini, best known for her roles in the TV series Freaks and Geeks and ER, and co-stars Michael Shannon and Mad Men's John Slattery. Critic David Edelstein has this review.
The coming home genre is so rife with stock ingredients that first I'd like to tell you what Liza Johnson's very fine drama Return doesn't do. The camera doesn't move in on returning vet Kelly, played by Linda Cardellini, as the sound of battle rises and she's back in her head on the front lines. The film doesn't give you what I call the psychodrama striptease, in which a past trauma is revealed piece by piece until you're finally, at the end, shown the essential bit. In fact, nothing in particular is said about what happened over there, including where over there is, Iraq or Afghanistan. Kelly mentions dead animals by the side of the road, knowing, like everyone, people who died, and some weird stuff. And that's it. So why is what's not in return important? Because it means the film is always in the present tense, the here and now, and that's crucial to its power. The deepest moments are, paradoxically, of surfaces, of Kelly staring out a car window at the nondescript Ohio Rust Belt landscape, broken by the occasional tidy neighborhood or industrial plant or boarded-up business. There are many long shots out her car window, but they're not, as in so many indie movies, meant to convey the sameness of everyday life. Cardellini's face is too expressive. Her Kelly is visibly relieved to be home, but she's not remotely at home. Some of us have waited since Freaks and Geeks to see Cardellini in a role this rich. She gives a remarkable performance, and one that's almost entirely inward. Kelly does at least attempt to come out of her shell for her family, a young daughter, another barely a toddler, and a husband played by Michael Shannon in a good, finely shaded portrait of a limited man. He's awkward with Kelly, going on about his plumbing jobs, clearly keeping something back, and their attempts at physical intimacy are increasingly rare. She impulsively quits her factory job for reasons she can't articulate. She throws back drinks with girlfriends, but it seems like a mechanical simulation of her old hell-raising spirit. Her only respite comes briefly with an older vet, Bud, played by John Slattery, whom she meets in a court-mandated class after she's arrested for drunk driving. Both their licenses are suspended, but that doesn't stop him from giving her a lift.
Jesus Christ, it must suck coming home with all these Oprah ass. You know, when I came back, nobody gave a nobody said a word, which sucked in its own way, but at least there wasn't anybody up my trying to get me to tell them. What was it over there that happened that made you the kind of person who would walk his cat on a leash?
I know, a lot of bleeps in that scene. It tells you a lot that someone so volatile is the one person who makes Kelly feel safe. Slattery captures brilliantly what's dangerous about some addicts. They do a better job acting like they're in the moment than people who are actually in the moment. His Bud is a hoot, and yet erratic and scary. And we pray that Kelly doesn't go down that same road. There must be 100 moments in return in which director Liza Johnson and her actors could take condescending shortcuts and slip into working-class stereotypes, but I didn't detect any slippage, only gifted performers disappearing into their characters. Near the end, there's a sequence in which the movie threatens to turn melodramatic, but the film is stronger for pulling back. The unresolved ending is one of the few of late that haven't made me want to cry, cheat. Return is quiet and naturalistic, but its plainness is suffused with anguish. With the barest of means, Johnson and Linda Cardellini evoke the emotional limbo of a vet who comes home to find no signs of the war we're fighting and no way to make sense of where she was and what it meant. That lack of resolution of a traditional story arc is what makes the movie feel so real. It's what Return doesn't do that has a lingering sting.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Return is now playing in New York and L.A., and on February 28th will be released across digital platforms, including Video on Demand and iTunes. Coming up, Viola Davis talks about her Oscar-nominated roles in The Help and in 2008's Doubt. This is Fresh Air Weekend. Our next guest, Viola Davis, is nominated for an Oscar for her performance in The Help. One of the actresses competing in the same Best Actress category is Meryl Streep, with whom Davis shared a scene in the 2008 film Doubt, which earned Davis her first Oscar nomination. She won a Tony for her performance in August Wilson's play Fences. Davis spoke with Terry last week. In The Help, which is set in the 1960s, Davis plays a maid named Abilene, who has spent her life working in white people's homes, raising their children. The woman she works for has a friend named Skeeter, who wants to be a writer. Skeeter decides to tell a story that she thinks has not been told before, the story of maids in the South. In this scene, after convincing a reluctant Abilene to share her story, Skeeter has gone to Abilene's home. Skeeter learns Abilene has an idea of her own.
I thought I might write my stories down and read them to you. And no different than writing down my prayers.
Okay. Sure.
I don't say my prayers out loud. I find I can get my point across a lot better writing them down. I write an hour, sometimes two, every night. And after my prayers last night, I got some stories down too.
Go ahead.
My first white baby to ever look after was named Alton Carrington Spears. He was 1925, and I just turned 14. I dropped out of school to help Mama with the bill. Alton's mama died of lung disease. I loved that baby, and he loved me. That's when I learned I could make children feel proud of themselves. Alton used to always be asking me how come I was black. Just ate him up. And one time I told him this because I drank too much coffee.
You should have seen his face.
It's my guest Viola Davis with Emma Stone in a scene from The Help. Viola Davis, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your Oscar nomination.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So I feel like I should start on this note, you know, that The Help is in its own way a very controversial film. I'll just paraphrase Melissa Harris Perry, who's a regular commentator on MSNBC and a professor of political science at Tulane and the author of a new book about stereotypes of black women. She said, "What kills me is that in 2011, Viola Davis is reduced to playing a maid." She's a big fan of yours. And even Tate Taylor, who wrote and directed The Help, said the role of Abilene, your role, with the wrong actress could turn into a cliché. Did you see the role as something that you were reduced to or something that was a cliché?
Absolutely not, or else I would not have done it. You're only reduced to a cliché if you don't humanize a character. Now, I have, in the past, played some pretty one-dimensional characters on page. They have had more upstanding occupations, so there hasn't been as much controversy surrounding them. But absolutely, their humanity was not explored. A lot of times they did not have a name. But for me, I did not see that with Abilene. I saw her having humor and heart and intelligence. I saw her as being having duality.
Now, there were women in your family who worked as maids. Who were they?
Yes. They were my mom. They were my grandmother. My grandmother, who had 18 children, 11 survived.
Wow.
They were both born in St. Matthews, South Carolina, Singleton Plantation, which is where I was born, at my grandmother's house. She delivered me. But my grandmom, she worked as a maid for most of her life. And she worked in the tobacco and the cotton fields at the same time, anything, any work she could get. And my mom would always say that she had employers who treated her very bad. Just made her work from sun up to sundown, taking care of their children, as well as cleaning their homes.
Your mother was talking about your grandmother when she was saying this?
Yes, because my mom worked as a maid, but she did not have as much cruelty, she said, when she was working as a maid. But one thing my mom did say was that the one highlight for my grandmother was the kids. that those kids remembered my grandmother throughout their entire lives.
Okay, I'm thinking your grandmother had 18 children, 11 survived, and of course she's spending her days taking care of other people's
yes.
children.
Yes.
Did she talk about what it was like to have so many children at home and be with somebody else's children?
You know what? I did not get to talk to my grandmother about that because, you know, she died 12 years ago. I talked to my mom about it. It's really hard for them to answer that question. And I think it's because they never quite thought about it.
I mean, it's kind of, that's the way it is, that's what you do.
That's just the way it is, and that's just what you do. I would talk to her all the time just about her life. Because one of the things I learned about women who lived in that time period is they had hard lives, all of them, hard. And I have to say that it takes years sometimes of constantly asking her the same question that I could finally get her to a place of comfort where she can even reveal a little, some secrets to me. She recently just told me that she could never really get into pork that much. And she said that, you know, they used to slaughter the pigs on the farm, the plantation. And she said one day she saw a pig and he was, they put him in a huge pot of scalding hot oil. And the pig was still alive.
Oh.
She said she could not get those screams out of her head. And that is the case with many memories of women who lived in that time period, that you just sucked it in. It's part of our history as African Americans. It's one of the reasons why I loved Abilene, because I saw all of that life in her.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Viola Davis. She's nominated for an Oscar for her role in The Help. Now, you were nominated for an Oscar for your role in Doubt few years ago. And in this movie, Meryl Streep played a very dominant and repressive nun who's the principal of a Catholic elementary school. And you played the mother of a 12-year-old boy, a boy who the nun suspects is having a, quote, improper relationship with a popular priest at the school. And so she's asked you to meet with her, and you're walking along the school grounds in this scene. I'm going to play a scene. And she's expecting you to be shocked by this news she's about to give you about, you know, your son's relationship to this priest. And she's baffled by your reaction because you say that you think his father has beaten him because he thinks the boy is gay. Mm-hmm. And so you speak first in this clip.
I'm talking about the boy's nature now. Not anything he's done. You can't hold a child responsible for what God gave him to be.
I'm only interested in actions, Mrs. Miller.
But then there's the boy's nature.
Leave that out of it.
Forget it, then. You're the one forcing people to say things. My boy came to your school because they were going to kill him in a public school. His father don't like him. You come to your school, kids don't like him. One man is good to him, this priest. Then does a man have his reasons? Yes. Everybody does. You have your reasons, but do I ask the man why he's good to my son? No. I don't care why. My son needs some man to care about him and to see him through the way he wants to go. And thank God this educated man with some kindness in him wants to do just that.
This will not do.
It's just till June.
I'll throw your son out of this school.
Why would you do that if it didn't start with him?
Because I will stop this.
You'd hurt my son to get your way.
It won't end with your son.
Throw the priest out then.
I am trying to do just that.
Then what do you want from me?
It's my guest, Viola Davis, with Meryl Streep in a scene from Doubt. When I saw you in that scene, I'd seen you in other movies, but I hadn't kind of put together who you were. When I saw you in that scene, I thought, like, whoa, like, who is that? So I read that this was not the take you wanted to use because, you know, you're kind of crying in that scene and your nose is dripping, it's kind of dripping into your mouth, and you saw that and you're like, you were just like so upset for days, but it's so effective. I mean, that's what happens when we cry. So tell me about what made you uncomfortable about that.
When you're watching yourself on screen, it's different from acting the scene. When you're watching yourself, it's about vanity. It's all about how you look, what's not looking right, the lips, the lighting, how big you look in that coat, you know, how you're holding the umbrella. It's like everything. When I first saw the cut, I remember I went back to my house and I just laid in bed for 2 weeks until my husband finally said, V, you got to get up. But, you know, doing that scene, it's such two people in absolute conflict that you're not so aware of what you look like until the scene is done. And also when I cry, my nose runs. So there you go.
In the two movies that you're best known for, which would be Doubt and The Help, you know, you play women who, well, in The Help, you're poor. And in Doubt, I'd say you're close to it or poor, mm-hmm. you know. And in both movies, you're in powerless positions. Mm-hmm. You're wearing, you know, clothes that are far from the finest.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You seem very, you know, beleaguered and weighed down in both roles. So it was so nice to see you in some glamour shots. I'm not big into glamour shots, you know, but it was just so much mm-hmm. fun to see you be beautiful in, was it Vogue? And, you know, the cover
of LA
Entertainment.
Oh, LA Magazine.
LA Magazine, yeah, and the cover of Entertainment Weekly. And, mm-hmm. I mean, you're wearing these, like, stylish clothes and, like, great hairdos. And I was like, oh, good, she could do that too. That's great.
Well, you know, that is another conversation in and of itself.
What's
you know,
the conversation?
Well, the conversation is how people see me. I can go into an audition, which I have, with my makeup on and my hair and my lashes, and come out with these roles that you say I have, which goes into the area of perception and how people perceive Black women of a certain hue. And when I say certain hue, I mean Black women who are darker than a paper bag. And I'm a dark-skinned Black woman who's 46 years old. And I don't know about you, but when I go to see movies, I don't see a lot of women like me in glamorous roles. And inevitably, when I say that, people always mention one person. They could always kind of think of one person, but usually just one. But I don't see a lot of narratives written where a woman who looks like me gets to be beautiful and sexualized. And, I don't know, upwardly mobile, middle class, funny, quirky.
So I'd like to hear a little bit more about your life. Would you describe the neighborhood that you grew up in Rhode Island?
My neighborhood, Central Falls, Rhode Island, over 18,000 people. And I moved there when I was 3 months old. We were the only Black family in Central Falls at the time. Now it's very racially diverse. And the income level is definitely middle class to very poor. I had a rough childhood, grew up in abject poverty, grew up with parents who, my father had a fifth grade education. I really don't believe he made it past second grade, but he says fifth grade. And my mom had eighth grade education. So the combination of all those things, you don't have a great self-esteem. And then on top of that, to be on the periphery is being different, being the only Black family. So we were teased a lot, picked on a lot. But mixed with that were a lot of great and fond memories.
So what was your first opportunity to actually act? And I don't mean in a major production. I just mean like in school or talent show or whatever.
I started when I was 8. My sisters and I, there was a local skit contest at the local park. So we decided to write a skit because we wanted to win this contest. It was a big deal in the city. We were always kind of teased and picked on, of course. So we said we're going to really create the best skit. And I was the writer, producer. My sister Dolores was the director, actor. My sister Diane, producer, like literally, we gave each other roles. We had rehearsals. We had rewrites. We even created a budget for wardrobe and costumes, and we bought our costumes at Salvation Army, and we won the skit contest. But I just thought that it was genius the way we pulled it off. You know, the way we sat down every night for hours. And I would literally do rewrites in the closet where the rats were. And I would say, there's rats in the closet. But my sister said, but we need a really great last line, Viola. Everything in the skit is working, but not the last line.
That's really funny. So now forgive me for ending on a note about clothing.
Okay.
Okay, so I read that you tried to sell on eBay the gown that you wore to the Oscars for Doubt. And I thought, why would you want to sell it on eBay?
Well, hey, listen, if I were more savvy and I had other options in my mind, I would have tried to sell it elsewhere. But at the time, the only thing I knew was eBay.
But why'd you want to sell it?
Because I didn't see the need to keep it. I'm not going to wear it again. I'm not that type of woman. So I said, maybe if I sell it, then I could take the money and the city that I grew up in, Central Falls, Rhode Island, is in dire need. It recently went bankrupt. They had closed the library and community center. And my sister Dolores is a teacher in the Central Falls Junior Senior High School system. And she has an acting program she teaches there. So I thought this is a chance to maybe raise money for programs. And I thought of it as a noble act. It's better than just keeping the dress in the closet and me never looking at it, which I wouldn't.
So this is a sister that you used to write sketches with when you were a child?
Yeah, she's one of them.
That's great.
She's one of them. Yes, she's the sister who's closest in age to me. So,
well, good luck at the Oscars. And
thank you so much
for talking with us.
Thank you.
Viola Davis is nominated for an Oscar for her performance as a maid in the film The Help. You can watch 3 scenes from that film on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Saman, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.